our equipment's coming in.
So I'm going to count on Mandy and Jeremy to let me know when all board members are present.
Yep, we're getting there. Just a little, this is Jeremy speaking, friendly housekeeping item. If you're from the public, please make sure you mute your mics and leave your camera off. That would be great. Thank you. Everybody, this is Jeremy again. We're just waiting on a few more board members to connect, so bear with us.
This meeting is being recorded.
Okay. Welcome, everyone. Thank you. We are beginning our regular board meeting on Tuesday, June 16th. I'd like to say welcome to the public. We had a study session prior to this meeting where we discussed a board bylaw. I'm going to talk about, give a little comment here about that this meeting, as you may have heard, is being recorded. And by Zoom, everyone is, the public is muted unless recognized to speak. All board members are present, correct? Okay, thank you. The first item is 4.01, a consensus on the order of business. Do we have consensus on the order of business? Yes, thank you. All right, and as always, please bear with me everyone, especially my fellow trustees, as I manage many pieces of paper here. Our next item, 4.02, is approval of the minutes of June 2nd, 2020. Any corrections? Questions? Comments? Otherwise, I would like a motion, please, to approve those minutes. Mr. Millar? You're muted?
Yes, I know.
Oh, okay. Okay. And a second, please, Mr. Buckman? Okay, I have a motion by Mr. Millar.
No. Hold
it. I'm sorry, Walt. I couldn't.
I'm trying to tell you I'm abstaining because I had to leave the meeting early.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Okay. So Mr. Buckman, you want to make the motion to approve, and Ms. Frame, I saw your hand up. Would you be our second? Thank you. Motion by Mr. Buckman, second by Ms. Frame. All in favor? Aye. So we have 6 in favor and Mr. Millar abstaining.
Don't you have to do a roll call vote?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I forget. All right. Mr. Buckman, Mandy made me this great sheet and everything. All right, Dr. Eisendrath Rogers. Okay. Ms. Frame. Mr. Millar is abstaining. Ms. Rogers. Ms. Strunger.
Yes.
And I vote yes as well. Okay. Thank you, Mandy. I did it. All right. Second is a presentation, item 5.01, Common Ground Advisory Task Force Recommendations. Dr. Prater? Oh.
I'll go ahead. So this is Whiteside, legal counsel from LaVon Smith for the district. This year, I was helping assist with the Common Ground Advisory Task Force as a kind of making sure that the process was moving and that we were getting valuable input for the district in coordination with Collaboration Business Consulting. And the task force, as you know, has been meeting for, it's now its third year. And the purpose of the Common Ground Task Force, just as a reminder, is to provide the superintendent with a perspective of different interests within the district and their perspective on school-related matters and action items to enact changes and make those recommendations on actions to the board. There's an idea in the law about free speech which says that there's this marketplace of ideas where we're supposed to be generating a lot of different viewpoints and having that come to us to inform our decision-making. The problem with the marketplace of ideas is that sometimes the one voice gets louder than the others, and other voices might not be as well heard, even though they are just as important. And so this Common Ground group is made up of a wide variety of individuals to provide that perspective and make it more apparent and more heard over the voice of maybe just one majority voice. And so this group met on multiple occasions to talk about equity and inclusivity, and then went and visited San Luis Obispo High School, Laguna Middle School, and Hawthorne Elementary School to see how these issues of equity and inclusivity are present and involved in the school curriculum and on campus. And so for many, they saw teachers who were communicating a visible, friendly, and accessible environment through their actions, through the classwork, through the materials that were displayed in the classroom. And it was really a positive experience for a lot of the task force members. So I think the district and its board can commend themselves on the environment and the safe environment that they've created for students and the ability for students to see themselves, even though if they are a minority student or a student with different viewpoints or beliefs that might not be reflective of the community as a majority, they were able to see that on the walls of their classroom and see that through their interactions in class. I think that's a good thing for the district to provide that place in the classroom for students to kind of contest their ideas and talk about different things that impact them. There were some issues, though, and so I'm going to have one of the facilitators, Gila, talk with you in just a couple seconds here about what the task force members saw and then what they recommended in relation to what they were, what these school visits did. Now, one of the big issues was that, of course, at the tail end of the school year, the schools all closed due to COVID-19, and the task force was raring to go to answer and provide some input and recommendations on how the district can address equity and inclusivity in light of that crisis. However, because the task force had already been in the process of making its recommendations on these other issues, and the fact that the crisis was pulling attention and time and resources from staff, the task force was not able to be provided a robust enough explanation of what all they were doing at that time to address COVID-19. So one of the goals for the task force for this upcoming school year is to address any issues related to access and equity and inclusivity for the following school year that might have been caused by this crisis during the spring semester and ongoing effects into the fall semester. So without further ado, I'll let Gila come up and speak about what these new recommendations from the task force are.
Great, thank you. I am trying to show myself, but I for some reason I'm not able to. I think I might be blocked here. So for now, you get to see my son and my puppy from a year ago. So that's who I am. My name is Gila Faragabagar. Oh, look, I got permission. Okay, hello. Hi, okay. Hi there. So I'm going to go through 6 new recommendations and 2 that were revised. So I'm going to read these verbatim for you all. So for those of you that are following along on the document, if you could go to page 2 under the title of Develop Curriculum that Supports Inclusivity, we have 1 revised recommendation. It's number 5. I'm going to go ahead and read that for you. Thank you, Nan. Thank you. I appreciate that you're showing this. So number 5, continue to provide mirrors and windows and curriculum materials and library books that are culturally responsive and reflect an inclusive view of the district's demographics and the world community. When curriculum books and materials do not meet these standards, provide guidance to teachers around how to supplement existing texts. Create incentives for administrators and teachers to focus on this issue in all schools, especially but not only at schools where there are large demographic variances. The effectiveness of this process may change the task force recommendation for recommendation number 2 above, which is require a diversity course as a graduation requirement. So that was the revised recommendation in that section. There is 1 new recommendation in this section as well. Go to number 7 on page 3. It's at the top of that page. There you go. Thank you. So this new recommendation is collect and analyze data on student demographic information, example given, race, gender, disability, in advanced honors classes and specialty classes compared to standard and remedial courses. Analysis should include how students are assigned to such classes after elementary school, which elementary schools the students in middle and high school advanced honors and specialty classes went to, and create action steps to address possible gaps, including those based on race, gender, and disability. I'm going to move on to the 2 next new recommendations under the section of provide ongoing professional development that supports inclusivity and a culture of care. The next new recommendation is number 4 here, promote greater communication from administrators with their staff about how they are planning to implement short-term and long-term concepts of civil discourse, inclusivity, and a culture of care at their schools. Next new recommendation is number 5, review promotion policies, hiring procedures, and professional development opportunities to help develop a leadership team over time that more closely reflects the district's student demographic population. Develop a model program to better retain staff who serve as leaders and as mentors for other staff members as well as students. The district should collaborate with other school districts and professionals in developing this model program. Moving on, let's go to page 4, the section titled Promote Student Clubs, Events, and Opportunities that Encourage Inclusivity. There are two new recommendations from the task force here. Number 4, invite donors and leaders of the district's education foundation, as well as other community leaders, to campus events and activities that promote and teach about diversity and inclusivity, and events and activities that reflect these ideals. Provide more information to student clubs about the availability of access to these community leaders. Also, because student clubs must be student-initiated, organized, and run, leaders of student clubs should be educated on how to promote equity and inclusivity. Number 5, new recommendation, brainstorm ideas to identify and develop systems and structures to support students who do not speak up for themselves to school staff due to their personalities and or existing and ongoing struggles and feelings of marginalization. Last 2, here we go. Under evaluate and reward inclusive behaviors, we have a revised recommendation. We could scroll down just slightly, kindly. Thank you. It's number 2 is a revised recommendation. Find ways to affirm progress on matters of equity and inclusivity, including through surveys of teachers and staff. And the final new recommendation is number 4. In this section, draw district trustee areas for board member elections commencing in 2022 in compliance with the California Voting Rights Act, while revising trustee bylaws to ensure that board members understand their responsibility for the district as whole, not just their trustee area. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila. And so these are just recommendations from community stakeholders made up of parents, teachers, staff, and other community members throughout the district for the superintendent to consider and then present to the board. This is also in line with the LCAP's, the design of the LCAP to have parent input and community input on decision-making regarding the LCAP for the board. Eric, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I just would like to thank Josh for his legal support and guidance. This can be a pretty challenging time for people when they have different opinions and different perspectives. And oftentimes the law comes up and what's legal, what's not legal. And so Josh and Mike Smith have been very helpful to that end, as well as helping to construct it so that it does line up with our LCAP and with our board priorities as well. So I really appreciate that. Sheila, I can't say enough about your facilitation and the work you've done along with Maggie and throughout the last few years. I just want to remind the board that this Common Ground Task Force is evolving. It grows, it ebbs and flows, but the one thing that remains the same is the desire to gather authentic feedback that can help support us as a district to ensure that all students, regardless of their backgrounds, have an opportunity and have access to successful opportunities throughout their schooling with us. This program, this structure, the Common Ground Advisory Task Force, this last year was acknowledged as a national model structure through the National School Boards Association. It earned a Magna Award, and I think for really good reason. So I appreciate the board's support. Obviously, I'll be working with my staff, my team, in the coming year, and I will say years, to refine and develop these recommendations as they do align to the board priorities, and they are, I think, best practices to aspire for. So I want to say thank you for sharing these recommendations, and I look forward to the journey ahead.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think we're always very interested to hear what you're discussing and the fruits of your labors and how they reflect the values and philosophies of the goals and with the ultimate goal of helping the students in our district. So thank you so much. Mr. Buckman.
Thank you. I want to echo what Ellen's saying. This is just an amazing, and it was just so much forethought on Dr. Prater and his staff's for creating the task force. I have two things. One, I'm yet again drawn to and especially support the diversity course as a graduation requirement. And I know that I've seen it offered somewhere else in the state. And I'd be happy to try and find that reference again. I'm also got a question for staff, and this doesn't have to be answered tonight, but there was something about adoption of materials, and I just want to know what the process is that we're using for adoptions. It's also my understanding that the district has been invited to do a presentation at CSBA this year on this task force and some of the other things that the superintendent has put in place. With the superintendent's permission, I did contact CSBA following the civil discourse that's going on in the country about possibly using this and other programs around the state for a webinar to help other school district cope with what's going on. So again, this is just amazing, and I really support all the work that's being done.
Thank you. Thanks again. All right, our next item is 5.02, another exciting topic, very forward-looking for our students, and that is senior highlights from Morro Bay, San Luis Obispo, and Pacific Beach High Schools. So,
yeah, I would just like I'd like to introduce, this is a celebratory moment, just to give the board a quick snapshot into where our seniors are heading next year. And I'd like to start, if I could, with Dr. Pruitt from Morro Bay High School. Provide us some highlights of where your kids are planning to go next year.
Hello, everybody. Hello from Morro Bay, and wanted to just let everyone know. First off, I want to remind the crew that this is our first sixth grade class that's graduating. So to remind the board, this is the first crew that came through sixth grade with us over at Los Osos Middle School, and we're seeing them off into the big, big, bold world. So we have 35 kiddos that are headed to four-year universities. We have a class of 166. 110 of them headed to Cuesta College. I was privileged yesterday to shake the hands of two young men who are headed to the military. They're headed to boot camp and won't be able to join us at our August graduation. So we did a kind of a mock graduation. I like to put on my cap and gown, and we did pictures for the families out in front of Morro Bay High yesterday, which was a lot of fun. And we'll see them off. We have one student headed to trade school. We have four students that are going to join the workforce. We have four students who are taking some time off before they start their second part of their career in school. And only seven students were undecided. Clearly our senior class is a focus class, is a driven class, and we're super excited. On another note, another highlight, this year we were able to award 152 scholarships to our senior class, totaling $191,000, to 48 different graduates. We are very proud of the work that Ben Gayot and staff do at Morro Bay High School to support each year the senior class, and also the strength of the coastal community. I think it just shines when it comes to their support of students coming out of Morro Bay High. So just really excited for this class, really excited about where they're headed. And, we'll just go Morro Bay Pirates.
That's great. Thanks, Kyle.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry, Kyle. I think something else that I noticed, I believe that Morro Bay High offered the most scholarships of any of the high schools in San Luis Obispo County at $190,000+. And I just want to, again, congratulate you guys and congratulate the coastal community and everybody who donated to the kids at Morro Bay High School.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Unger.
Thank you so much. Thanks a lot. It's great to see you.
Good to see all of you.
Next up, Mr. Dowler from Pacific Beach High School. Chris, are you out there?
Yes. Yeah, I'm out here. How's it going, guys?
Good.
Here he comes.
Yeah, man, I put on a collared shirt and everything for the presentation.
All right. And we appreciate it, Chris.
Yeah, man. I do my best, you know, staying professional. All right, so I have something written up. This school year at Pacific Beach High School, we had 23 students complete their graduation requirements. To say we were surprised by the number of graduates who actually completed would be an understatement. Many of our students were not only displaced by school closures, but were displaced by the economic and social hardships their families faced. Distance learning was difficult for our program because of the nature of our work depends on daily individual connections between staff and students. Without this connection, many of our students struggled academically during this period, and yet more students completed their requirements in the end than we initially anticipated. We hope to have a traditional in-person ceremony in September of 2020. On June 4th, though, our staff rallied for a drive-by event to celebrate our students in person. All staff members caravan to each individual student's house to celebrate with gift bags and take photos. Because many of our graduates face economic hardships, we encourage that they apply for academic scholarships. Currently, $30,000 in scholarships has been awarded to our graduates. Approximately three-quarters of our graduates plan to attend Cuesta College in August 2020. I want to take this opportunity to recognize the impact of trauma on students and the role of schools in providing students with not just a high-quality instruction, but also acting as a social-emotional stabilizing influence. I was incredibly proud of our staff and students rallying during this COVID crisis to continue connecting, continue communicating, and showing the type of resilience that is necessary for success in life. Above all, I hope our students felt seen, that they felt proud of their accomplishments. We as a staff recognize where each student comes from, what they face, and try our best to support them towards success. What I noticed at our drive-by event was the gratitude on each graduate's face. That gratitude keeps us going. If we can light the way to this accomplishment, we hope that our students will not doubt the next. I also want to celebrate, as one student said, when we all came to his door, woke him up out of bed, and gave him his gift basket. Quote, what other school shows up at your house to give you a graduation present?
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, guys.
You know that all these schools are near and dear to our hearts, but Pacific Beach, we love their graduation. I'm speaking for myself, but I would assume the rest of the board will agree that we really missed it this year.
Yeah, we did too, and, you know, we're hopeful, but we'll see what happens. But thank you for that.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Dowler, thank you for all the work you do, and I'm just super happy that you're able to keep your kids close to you during this time. And I look forward to honoring them along with the board in September.
Yeah,
and,
me too.
Way to go.
Thank you.
And then bringing up the rounding third is San Luis Obispo High School. Mr. O'Connor, would you like to share some highlights from your school?
Absolutely. Mandy, can you bring me on video or not?
Yeah, I'll do it right now.
It's happening.
All right.
Stand by. There you are.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. As Kyle said, hey, crew, how are you doing? I like that reference. Hey, crew, how are you doing? Right? Chris, thank you so much for attending our drive-through celebration on Friday the 5th. Really, really appreciate that. It was a little longer than what we had expected, but we had a lot of fun out there together. This year at San Luis Obispo High School, we honored 367 graduates, which was a tremendous group of students that we had through the 4 years here at school. I'm happy to report that 182 of those 367 have reported that they will be attending four-year universities in the fall, just over 50%. Of that, in the CSU system, we have 86 students going to a CSU high school. 57 of them are going to Cal Poly, which is a tremendous honor and a tremendous reflection for our community and the connection that we have with our four-year university that's right here in our own backyard, which is a tremendous school in itself. 36 of our 182 graduates will be attending the UC system in the fall for a 10% pretty much, which is what we would expect. Ironically enough, UC Santa Cruz come in as the heavy hitter and the big winner this year for our students going to the UC system. We have 12 students going to go to become a banana slug with UC Santa Barbara not far behind. Berkeley rounds it out in the third spot. Usually it's a tight race between Cal and UCLA, but this year it's UC Santa Cruz. Ironically, we're seeing a lot of our students starting to go out of state for school, for university. 34 students going to go out of state. Boise State is doing a tremendous job recruiting our students now to go out of state. And we have 26 students planning on attending private colleges and universities all across the country. And, of course, we are very, very honored and very pleased to have 140 of our graduates planning on taking advantage of the Cuesta Promise and staying local and making their transition after Cuesta to a four-year university. Much like Kyle said, we have some students that are going to support our military. We have two entering the Marine Corps, one entering the Navy, one entering the Army, and one is attending West Point. We have a handful of students who have plans to go straight into the world work full-time, and a few students are talking about taking a gap year. But very proud of all our graduates, very proud of the work that they have done over the past 4 years, very proud of our staff for the work that they've done and our counseling team to bring them along. And I would echo Chris Dowler's sentiments. We really had the work cut out in the last trimester since March to support all of our students, and especially our senior students, as they make this transition through 2020. Ironically enough, our senior group, as an eighth grade group, suffered some food poisoning when they were in eighth grade. They remember back when they were good, they had an incident of food poisoning, and they had a really traumatic eighth grade answer that John Calendar was trying to pull together. It's also really interesting that our graduating class in 2020 really had an eventful 18 years in our American history. And very much historic, significantly historic 20 year for themselves. So thank you for the support, and that's for our senior group.
Thank you, Leslie. I think that during this difficult period of time with coronavirus, it is so wonderful for us to realize how much we have to celebrate with our students. And I hope that they're aware that we celebrate them from afar. We wish we were close. This is tough for every board member. We're so accustomed to having the opportunity to shake every student's hand and recognize their achievements. And I know it's hard for administrators as well, but get the word out, please, that we're so proud and really have not forgotten about them and wish that we were able to celebrate their successes with them. Please wish them the best of luck from all of us. And Dr. Prager.
Honored.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. All right, our next item is 6.01. And I have to do a little moving around here while I get things in front of me. At the time of the agenda was published, there was an email from the board had received official correspondence from T. Hughes. And then we're moving on to 6.02, which is the time for public comment. At this time, the board welcomes comments on matters of district interest. The board will listen but cannot engage in discussion or take action on items not listed on the agenda due to the Brown Act. each speaker may have is limited to 3 minutes, and we have timekeepers here to keep track of that. And at this point in our also electronic submission of public comments may be set by, there's a link on the agenda where you can send comments, and we will read those into the record. Let's see, I want to make sure I'm doing this correctly. At this time, if there's anyone from the public who wishes to address the board on an item either not listed on the agenda or that is on the agenda, but you would prefer not to wait for that item to come up, now is the time. Do we have anyone?
And to do such, just raise your hand in the little column. We all have used Zoom so much, but if you haven't, just click on participants, and then from there you can raise your hand or show an emotion, and that'll be get my attention, and then we'll call on you. So go ahead.
Do we have anyone at this time wishing to address the board?
Nicole would like to address the board.
Okay. Nicole, please state your full name, and your time is beginning now.
Okay. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. My name is Nicole Dorfman, and I have 2 children in the San Luis Coastal District. And I want to thank you so much for all the work that you're doing, and I want to comment on your reopening plan. And thank you so much for all the work you're doing. I've read the document, and I can see you've put a tremendous amount of thought and energy into it. So I want to let you all know that my family strongly supports Plan A, which includes the least restrictive environment, and we thank the board for selecting this option as a preferred option for the fall. And we believe that it best addresses the educational as well as the socio-emotional and developmental needs of children. We also ask that you prioritize the full resumption of student athletics to the greatest degree possible and consider the large body of research which demonstrates how important organized sports are for the overall health and wellness for our young boys and girls, young men and women. The one concern that I do have is the call for flu clinics in all the schools. And I question why this is even a part of the reopening plan, because there is no evidence that the flu shot protects against COVID-19. And I see that the whole plan is around protecting against COVID-19. If we want to protect against the flu, then that's, another discussion. But somehow it seems to me to be incongruous, especially so there is no evidence that a flu shot protects against COVID-19. But there is peer-reviewed research showing that the flu shot can increase the risk of coronavirus. And I will email the board members this research. So thank you so much for your time and your careful consideration. I really appreciate all the work that you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Michelle Ciaretas. Please excuse me if I'm mispronouncing your name.
Thank you. It was Ciaretas. I just had a comment regarding the first thing on the agenda, the Common Ground Task Force. When it was announced that data would be tracked by race, gender, and disability, I would also encourage everyone to track it by English language proficiency, the number of reclassified students taking those classes, and home languages. So you can get a better idea of how the English learners in San Luis Coastal are doing in those particular classes. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else at this time? Okay. Thank you. We will move on to our superintendent's updates. First, it is 7.01 business and budget update.
Yeah, just a couple of quick updates for the board. Legislature, despite not reaching agreement with Gavin Newsom over a budget for this year, did go ahead and pass a budget through the legislature on Monday, the 15th, which is the constitutional deadline. And basically, it was kind of focused on their goal of not cutting schools and adding the deferrals at this time. I think there's approximately about 10 days now that they have to negotiate and potentially come out with some changes that could be made. But I think the legislature and the governor are probably, you know, haggling it out right now over the next few days to see what they can come to. So I don't have anything specific to share with the board right now, as a lot of those details will come out once the officially signed, you know, kind of budget comes forward, and I will be sure to share that with all of you as soon as I get it. I also want to let the board know that a lot of interest in, of course, using that pool at Morro Bay High by the public again with the program through the city. And so they did, with the opening of, you know, various establishments in our county, they did allow for some public pool use. So I have talked to Scott Collins, the city manager there, Kirk Carmichael, who is in charge of their programs in terms of rec department things. And they will be trying to work with Penny Bornstein in setting up a program that they can then establish. And once they have an approved program, they will be meeting with me and hopefully allowing at least for some lap swim at this time, and maybe some small exercises classes of 10 or less. And again, through that city program. So that's more to come, but I just want to give it up for anybody in the public who was inquiring about that. And that's it.
Thank you. Dr. Elizabeth Rogers, you need to unmute. Catherine, you need to unmute.
Thank you for your patience there. And Ryan, so can you give us the update then on SLO High School in that regard?
SLO High School, we haven't closed the pool project out yet. So they haven't turned over the pool to us. So we don't have anything at this time in terms of a use. And so we're going to have to, you know, and I think we've talked about this in terms of the SLO High pool use, and really both pools in terms of our students or other uses. We're kind of waiting on Penny Bornstein. So, you know, we have the county. So they have not officially allowed any athletics yet. So that has been a question we have asked the county health to kind of see if there's any guidance in that direction. And you know, I'm sure as we find out from them, and Kim, I don't know if Kim will have any, you know, she can add in her update if she has any other news. But I'm pretty sure that right now the any athletics is kind of off limits at this time. So we'll see how it goes, you know, into the future. But the SLO High pool should be, I want to say about 2 weeks now, is when they're going to be turning that over to the district for use.
It looks gorgeous. It's an infinity pool that goes beyond. So well done.
Very nice. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Next is our educational services update.
Great. Thank you. Just a few things to update you on. Want to let you know that extended school year, so our summer school for our special education students, is beginning June 22nd. That will be some in-person summer school. We submitted the summer school plan to the public health department. It was approved, and they did add that we needed to take student temperatures. So just to give you kind of an idea, we have 12 classes at 6 different school sites and less than 10 students in each class. So that's just an update about ESY coming up here pretty soon. Some really positive stuff going on at Baywood with the new dual language immersion program, a fantastic kinder team coming together and starting that planning. Just love hearing about how they're finding the things that are unique to Baywood. They're really emphasizing a combination of student academic achievement along with having kids engaged, excited, and making it unique to Baywood. So some great stuff going on there. So excited about that kinder team. And it seems like they really bring kind of different strengths to the table. So it's great it sounds like a great group together. Just to give you a quick update on Aries, as you'll remember, we're moving our student information system from PowerSchool to Aries. So excited about the capabilities and what it's able to do for us, I think is really a game changer. So that rollover is happening July 13th. I want to give a big shout out to ISNT, Jeremy, who's here, especially Kim Rohde, Jamie Fazio, who have just worked tirelessly. So if you see them, come across them, give them a a distant high five or a distant hug and let them know. They've, I mean, just been so incredibly dedicated. So great to see. For any parents listening, the parent portal information will come out at, you know, towards the beginning of August. So it will be new parent portal info for you to register within so that you can see your student information. And we'll also conduct our online enrollment through Aries as well this year. So more to come around that. Also, just a shout out to Rick Mayfield and our equity team. A lot of incredible equity work took place this year. It's weird when I look through this list of some of the highlights. It seems like forever ago that some of those things were taking place, but it's actually not that long ago. But just a quick summary. Seven different sessions happen of Equity Institute with Tovi and Atoko. You probably heard about them. Just kind of questioning our own thinking and our own practices and continuing to move those things forward. A two-day gender spectrum training took place, as well as a bystander and upstander training, kind of teaching our kiddos how to stand up for those things and notice them and do it in a respectful way. The district equity team is continuing to work on many projects, even did a parent information night with Raise Up Slow. So lots of great work there, and I know that work will continue next year. So thanks to everyone on the equity team and Rick Mayfield for leading that. Lots of great work happening there. I will have a couple of items. Look forward to talking to you about dual enrollment and our reopening plans.
Thank you. Mr. Millar.
Please
unmute. You need to unmute.
I apologize that I had questions. I was able to listen to the audio from the board meeting that I had to check out of early. And I just had a quick question for Ryan, and if it's going to be a long answer, then, you know, we can do it at some point. But in the budget adoption, you were talking about potential deferrals, and my question was, these deferrals, we're going to expect monies later. How does this affect our slow County Office of Ed analysis of our budget?
Yeah, well, we're San Luis Coastal. I mean, that we receive some state funding, but most of us are, of course, is through property taxes. So, it really is a cash flow issue for most school districts because they're promised money, but they don't receive, you know, like in a normal cycle. So, but for us, talking with County Treasury, because we have our reserves that the board has kind of set for the past, we're okay through that cash flow. The deferral shouldn't affect us very much. But for a lot of school districts, that is definitely something that they're going to consider or have to consider. And then ultimately, too, in terms of the budget, you know, the worry is that by putting off these potential cuts, if the economy doesn't recover, if they don't have money in the future to pay those deferrals, they're just kind of putting the cuts off to a later time, which is what Governor Newsom was trying to, you know, deal with the May revise. But, you know, with everything, in light of everything going on in the world today, a lot of school districts were, you know, definitely balking at the idea of having to deal with 10% cuts and, you know, and dealing with the, you know, pandemic. So that's basically kind of what's happening with deferrals. Okay. And then in terms of the bond measure, the bond update, just so that the board knows, I you know, we have a Citizens Bond Oversight Committee that oversees all of our Measure D spending. I was able to walk that group around San Luis Obispo High School to look at all the projects. You know, went through the student services building, new performing arts space, new gym, the pool. You know, by the fall, that whole bottom half of San Luis Obispo High School will be complete. And then we walked up and saw the gutted out 100 building, you know, through the south side. And they've done all the asbestos and abatement through the middle. It's been great to get a lot of that work done without kids there. The wood shop is very close to being completed, and the new bathrooms and computer lab up by the 300 wing. They've cleared out the welding shop because that's next in terms of the focus. So there's just, this is really crunch time now with Measure D, both at San Luis Obispo High School and Morro Bay High School. Other than that, we've been really, you know, diving into the budgets a lot. Mr. Holcomb, myself, the team, our architects, our Acme Construction, look at, you know, how we can get all of these projects accomplished with the funds that we have left available. And so we've made some great gains. In fact, Mr. Bonin, Mr. Holcomb, Aaron Primer met today even to talk about the kitchen spaces at Slo High, Morro Bay High, and just lots of things, you know, really diving into it. so that we can make sure that we complete everything that we have, we've talked to the board about. So more update will come on that in July. Mr. Holcomb will give kind of a budget update at that point and kind of where we're at and the things that he's been working on with us. And I look forward to sharing with you.
Thank you. All right, we are moving on to item 8.01, which is a resolution number 23-1920, recognizing social injustice.
Thank you, Madam President. I just want to acknowledge that this resolution is largely in part to the recent events that occurred with George Floyd in Minnesota. His tragic death, I think, rocked our nation in many respects. It really highlighted the decades and decades of social injustice that I think I believe our African American communities suffer from and continue to deal with. And this resolution is a response to that, and it's an acknowledgement that that is a daily fact and reality for our Black families and in this country and in our community. And this resolution aligns, I think, with our values of supporting members of our student community and family community that are marginalized and somehow don't feel like they have a voice. And so knowing that our district has focused on equity, inclusivity, and a culture of care, and will continue to build school environments that are safe and engaging for all students, I put this resolution in front of you to signal that we are working in a very focused manner to support not just our African-American families and students, but also all marginalized communities in our district.
Thank you. It's my understanding. First, I'd like to see if there is anyone from the public who would like to speak to this issue. None. Thank you. I will bring it back to the board for discussion. Any questions, comments? Okay. Mr. Unger, then Ms. Roger, then Mr. Millar.
I was just going to say I would be proud to make the motion for this resolution. I think it's necessary. I'm glad that we're being proactive on it. I think that this codifies some of the things that we talked about earlier with Common Ground, but it specifically does talk about Black Americans and the work that needs to be done in this country regarding racial justice. So I'm going to make that motion.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Roger?
I would like to hear the resolution, please.
All right. I'm happy to read it. Mr. Millar, would you like to ask your question first or before or after I read it?
I'd like to hear you read it. I'm just a little bit of the language that, anyway, so go ahead and read it, please, and then I'll see if I still have questions.
Thank you. Resolution number 23-1920, recognizing social injustice. Whereas protests have swept the nation as demonstrators demand justice in response to the killings of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and far too many other Black Americans to list. And whereas the Board of Education is committed to maintaining a safe, positive school environment where all students, staff, parents, guardians, and community members are treated with respect and dignity. And whereas the Board of Education believes that diversity that exists among the district's community of students, staff, parents, guardians, and community members is integral to the success of the district's vision, mission, and goals. And whereas addressing the needs of the most marginalized learners requires recognition of the inherent value of diversity and acknowledgement that educational excellence requires a commitment to equity in the opportunities provided to students and the resulting outcomes. And whereas the Board of Education made equity a board priority, creating the Common Ground Advisory Task Force, District Equity Team, and the Superintendent Student Senate to help guide the direction of San Luis Coastal Unified School District. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the San Luis Coastal Unified School District Board of Trustees stands strongly with our Black students, staff, families, and community, and vows to reflect upon its policies, values, and priorities to ensure its commitment that all means all. Be it further resolved, the Board of Education continues, Be it further resolved, the Board of Education vows to continue to work proactively to identify class and cultural biases as well as practices, policies, and institutional barriers that negatively influence student learning, perpetuate achievement gaps, and impede equal access to opportunities for all students in order to eradicate institutional bias of any kind, including implicit or unintentional biases and prejudices that affect student achievement, and to eliminate disparities in educational outcomes for students from historically underserved and underrepresented populations. Be it further resolved, the Board of Education vows to make decisions with a deliberate awareness of impediments to learning faced by students of color and or diverse cultural, linguistic, or socioeconomic backgrounds. And then adopted the 16th day of June, 2020 by the Board of Education of the San Luis Coastal Unified School District by the following roll call vote. So that is the resolution in its entirety. Ms. Roger, then Mr. Millar. Ms. Roger, unmute please.
Resolution is a little confusing to me. In that certainly I support, equity and equality for marginalized students and for Black students specifically in the beginning of the resolution, but then later on in the resolution, it sounds like it's addressing all marginalized students. And so I don't know why we would just be calling out Black students in the beginning, why this resolution wouldn't address everyone who has been marginalized over time and continues to be, where we strive to change that in our district. So that would be Black students. It would be brown students. It would be students who are immigrants. It would be students with disabilities. I mean, it would cover the whole group of marginalized students. So I'm not clear why this seems like it's a response to something that is happening in the news right now, to one, and it addressing the injustice to one specific group. Where wouldn't we want to address injustice to all of our students who need that acknowledgement?
Mr. Millar, were your questions answered or your concerns?
No, I appreciate what Marilyn's saying. I actually was kind of reacting to the now therefore be it resolved paragraph, because there's a little disconnect, and I kind of appreciate what Marilyn is saying. You know, just brainstorming this, where we acknowledge the demonstrations and the response to the killings of those people and and far too many other Black Americans to list, to me, that would be a great location to put now, therefore, be it resolved that the San Luis Coastal Unified School District of Trustees stand strongly with our Black students, staff, family, community. Because I read that Black students and Black staff and Black families and Black community. I don't know if that was what the intent was when it was written, but I think that is a wonderful thing to be resolved, particularly in connection with the travesties that we witnessed and some of us throughout our lives. And then I think the language about the vulnerable and supporting students of all ethnicities and capabilities makes more sense, but that's just kind of my reaction to it.
Any further comments or discussion or questions? So I'd like to return to Walter and Marilyn briefly, just to make sure I'm clear. Are you, would you like to suggest revisions at this time, or what would, I understand your comments, and I'm wondering whether you're suggesting we take another look at this, we bring it back, we go ahead with the vote, or what you, if you have a desire at this time, or if we take the vote and see where it lands. Ms. Roger.
For me, I think if this is a sort of a response to Black Lives Matter, then I can certainly accept and support it as that. But I think we need to modify then the paragraph that talks about all students and have it stand alone as a response to what's going on currently regarding treatment of Black Americans. Or given if we don't take out that paragraph that has to do with all people, all students, whatever, it's just it doesn't make sense to me. It's like it's talking about two different things. If we take out that paragraph, and as Mr. Millar suggested, just have the resolution end above where it's just addressing Black inequality, then I can support that. But I have a hard time with it as it is. I hope I was articulate enough on that.
Get my there.
Mr. Buckman?
Yeah, I appreciate Marilyn's comments. And as I read this, and Walter's comments as well, the way I read it was, now therefore be resolved refers directly to the comments above. And then it says, be it further resolved. And so that's a secondary group that we're going to include as we do it. And then the third is, be it further resolved. So I'm kind of okay with it the way it is. So I'll just throw that out. And when you're ready for a second, I'll second it.
Okay. Is there any further, Mr. Millar?
Thank you. Well, first of all, it's a hard resolution to be not in favor of. I think it's an incredibly important statement, but I do think it's an incredibly important statement about what is happening today and what we're seeing on our TV screens and what we are seeing in prosecutions, law enforcement officers who are abusing their authority. I think it would be helpful to maybe have it reviewed, and I'm just going to suggest that we make a much more direct, powerful statement about it's what's happening today on our streets and what has led up to that occurrence, those occurrences.
Mr. Buckman?
I can't get my hand in the right place today.
You know, as soon as you lift it, I see it, Mark. So you
okay, you can see it over here. what I'm hearing Walter say is we could make a more powerful statement, and in response to that, my thought is that this is fresh and, in my opinion, needs an immediate and strong response. I think this lets us do that, and if we feel like we need to do something later on, I think that would be have my support as well. I'm so excited that the district was way out at the forefront of this. I'm so excited that the Common Ground Task Force is making clear and concrete suggestions to change the way that we do business in the district. So I'm just going to support this as it stands now because I think it's important to make a statement now.
Well, I'm a little torn because I agree that it's important to make a statement, but I want to make it correctly. And if we can make it a little, strengthen it and make it a little more direct, then that's, I don't mind. We meet again in a couple of weeks. We're hearing, you know, we're making remarks now and comments that we certainly are aware of this and understand the importance. And I would like it to be a very clear and strong and direct statement. So that's where I stand. Any further comments before we bring it to a vote, Mr. Buckman?
Yeah. So, Mr. Malarkin, can you put forward some kind of wording that you would see that would be different than this to make it, I think what you were saying, more direct or stronger?
I would probably do a more detailed recitation of what the recent events and the reactions that the public and in general and our community is having to it. And I would probably keep to a minimum, no offense, but the kind of boilerplate language about supporting all students, et cetera, and tailor it so that it's more specific. But I'd rather not try to wordsmith it right now. And it's, you know.
Thank you.
Mr. Unger?
Well, I made the motion. I would certainly support a stronger statement that that the board seems to be talking about. I do, though, think that it's important for us to acknowledge that this is happening right now, as Mark has talked about. And I'm wondering if there's a way of threading that needle. I would certainly be, I'm not sure if I, at this point, I can withdraw my motion, but I would only do so with the assurance that we come back with something even stronger that acknowledges the injustices that have occurred in this country, not only within the past few weeks, but historically.
Okay, it looks like it appears as though you're getting support for that from thumbs up, but I do think, I don't know, Mr. Unger, if you'd like to revise your motion, or I know, or you can, or if it dies for, well, it has a second with Mr. Buckman. If we vote on it now and then we make another vote to accommodate what's been the statements that have been made here, but how do you wish to proceed? It's your motion.
My problem is if we go forward and we feel that this statement isn't strong enough, then the logical conclusion is that we would vote no on that. And what I'm afraid is that folks might realize that we voted no on that we don't support this. So that's the concern I have. I'm not sure given parliamentary procedure, if I can withdraw my motion. I believe Mr. Buckman would need to approve that as well. Mark, would you be willing to approve that we bring this back with stronger language that we talked about?
We would need to withdraw his second, and then we would start.
No, I'm sorry. I don't know of any process within Robert's Rules of Order that A, places it on the person that seconds the motion, And I also don't know anything that would allow us not to vote on this at this point. There's a first.
Oh, no, nothing. No, we would need, if Chris is uncomfortable with his motion at this point, it's my understanding he can withdraw his motion.
Okay.
Okay.
Then I'm willing to withdraw the motion because it looks like the consensus of the board is to have stronger language, which is what I would support. And so I guess I'll withdraw my motion, asking though that this be brought back with it no later than our next board meeting, which I believe is in 2 weeks. I think it's June 30th, is it not? With revised language that talks about some of the things that I just discussed.
Mr. Millard?
I could support that, and I'm wondering if maybe the board, certainly in view of our previous discussion today, would like to issue a joint statement that talks about our discussion and what our intentions are with regard to a resolution regarding the treatment of both poor people that are identified and then the countless other people who suffered under these kinds of racism.
So are you suggesting, Walt, something to the effect of, you know, the board discussed this today and will be coming forward with a resolution? I mean, I'm trying to figure out what you're asking for here.
Yes, in a way. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. If we proceeded to a vote, I would vote for it. Not going to let the good be the victim of the perfect, but
you sound like Jim Quesenberry.
Thank you, Jim. So my thought was, if we really, as a board, want to rework this, then why don't we issue a statement about why we tabled it and are bringing it back? A public statement that demonstrates our support for our Black students, community, staff, parents, and that we are intending to make a more direct statement in the near future.
Second that.
Okay, I see thumbs up with that.
Yeah.
All right, this is Roger. All right. Okay, it looks like that is the goal. Dr. Prater, is that clear for you?
Yeah, I apologize. I will revise this and build stronger language.
Yeah, no apologies necessary. This is a collaborative effort.
No, it is. It is. And I have no problem. I understand what the concerns are, and I will work on this.
Okay. All right. So at this time, Mr. Millar?
I just want to make sure that so we can we rely on Clerk and Dr.
Yes.
Peter to work on a board statement?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Perfect.
Yes. Mr. Buckman?
I'm sorry. Maybe I misunderstood. What I thought I heard was that we would be going ahead and voting on this and then coming out with a board statement that may be stronger or in recognition of what's going on. If I misunderstood that, I apologize, but that's what I heard. So can you clarify for me?
Yeah, my understanding, and you're right, this is important to have clear, is that we'll be developing a more directed resolution and bringing that forward to the board to vote on at our next meeting. That we will not vote on this one today. And
yes.
I see nods, so, okay.
That as the maker of the motion, that was my understanding, and that's why I'm willing to withdraw the motion pending a different resolution, a more strongly worded resolution.
Okay, thank you. All right, thank you. And I want to confirm with Mandy that she's got all this. You good? Yep, she says yeah. Okay, great. All right, next is item 8.02. Resolution number 24-1920 with regard to the 2021-22 instructional calendar Lincoln Day revision.
Hi, Ms. Shepherd. I'll take care of this for Ms. Newland. This is just complying with Ed Code because the day for Lincoln did not fall within the week that's approved, so we have to do this waiver.
All right. Is there anyone from the public wishing to discuss this? No. Thank you. All right. Any board discussion? And if not, then a motion, please. All right. Mr. Unger.
So moved.
Second.
Thank you. We have a motion by Mr. Unger and a second by Mr. Millar. And I will do our roll call vote. Mr. Buckman. He's gone. Dr. Eisendrath Rogers.
Aye.
Ms. Frank. Mr. Millar, yes.
Aye.
Ms. Roger? Mr. Unger?
Yes.
And I will vote yes as well. So that motion carries 6-0. Is Mr. Buckman has stepped off for a moment. Is that correct? All right. Thank you. Next is item 8.03, resolution number 25-1920, delegation of signature authority.
Yeah, each spring we bring to the board this delegation resolution, which basically outlines who can sign checks and POs for the school district. And so we just ask for your approval today, and this will get us established for next school year.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the public here to address this item? No. All right. Thank you. Then, Ms. Roger.
If there's no board discussion of this, I'll move approval of this pro forma resolution.
I'll second.
All right. We have a motion by Ms. Roger, a second by Mr. Millar. Here we go. Mr. Buckman. Dr. Eisengrass Rogers.
Yes.
Ms. Frame. Mr. Millar.
Yeah. Aye.
Ms. Roger.
Yes.
Mr. Unger.
Yes.
And I will vote in favor as well. Thank you. Okay. We on target? Mandy, I think I just marked things in the wrong table, but that's for you to figure out. Sorry. Next is 9.01. Is that where we are? Morrow Elementary Surplus.
8.04.
I didn't mark it in the wrong place. I'm just turning my pages too quickly.
So this is...
Sorry, let me just give the introduction in case people need it.
Sure.
Resolution for Measure D, the SLO High School New Gym Modernization Lease Act, termination of lease.
Yeah, so as the board knows, we have completed the new gym project. And so with that, since this was done under a lease back delivery method for construction, it's time to terminate that lease. So you'll actually see three things on the board agenda tonight. Or today, I should say, and that would be the resolution which you have in front of you to approve. There's actually the termination of the lease in the action, and then the kind of finalizing of the notice of completion and action consent. So we're asking the board tonight to go ahead and terminate that lease since the project has been completed, and this resolution is the first step.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the public here to address this? I'd like to say that the new gym looks amazingly wonderful. It's just great. So
yeah, I look forward to taking the board through it.
Yeah, it's great. So without further ado, do we have a motion on this? Mr. Millar.
I just want to ask a quick question. Are we going to come up with a better name than the new gym? But anyway, I will move resolution number 26-19-20.
Dr. Eisenjeth Rogers.
Hey, the good news, Walt, is it's actually new now.
Now it's a new gym. All right. Mr. Unger.
Yes.
Ms. Roger. Yes. Mr. Millar.
Yes.
Ms. Frame. Yes. Dr. Eisenjeth Rogers.
Yes.
Mr. Buckman. Yes. All right. I think I'm back on track. Sorry. All right. 9.01, Morrow Elementary Surplus Property Analysis.
Yes, I'd like to, first of all, just frame out this presentation. This is phase two of the final report that the board approved back in, I want to say February or sooner even, right before we our schools for COVID. And so they already presented, Deloitte and Reach have already presented phase one. And I'm happy to report that tonight or today is phase two of the final report. And we have been meeting regularly with Mr. Holcomb, Mr. Pinkerton, myself, and the Deloitte group, as well as the Reach group, formerly Hourglass. I'd like to thank Francesca and Dave from Deloitte for their work on this, along with the help, of course, of Melissa James and Andrew Hackelman from Reach. And with that said, there's no decision tonight. It's just the presentation of this final report. We will revisit this report again in a study session in July and then again in August to continue the board's absorption and opportunities to of the material and opportunities to ask questions. This is pretty thick and dense. So tonight I asked just for a basic overview. And again, I'd like to say thank you, Francesca. Dave, you're up.
Thanks so much, Dr. Prater. Andrew, just to kick off, did you want to say a few words on behalf of Reach?
Francesca, I can do that if that's okay.
Yeah.
Great to be with you all, members of the board. Thank you for the opportunity just to come before you with this analysis. We're excited that the Deloitte team is here with us virtually as well. I think the last time we met with you, it was just days before the shelter in place or the shelter at home order. So there's certainly been a lot that has been happening since then. And we just thank you for the work that you have been doing to continue to educate the district students and to plan and prepare for the reopening of schools in the fall. So thank you for that. Just as a really high level kind of intro for the members of the public who maybe haven't spent as much time with the material, the work that Deloitte and Reach have brought forward at the board's request is a robust, financial and feasibility study related to the future potential use of the Morrow Bay property. And I think it's an important context just to remind folks that the real reason why this conversation has been so critical and important is because of the budgetary impacts of the Diablo Canyon closure and the $8 million in property tax revenue that will be lost to the school district's budget. And so the conversation here today is really about what are the innovative approaches to creating new revenue for the school district and looking at the highest and best use of surplus properties for that. And the tool before you today in this report really is just a framework for decision making for the board to be able to look at the many different options, have a robust financial analysis that is complemented by quite a lot of community and stakeholder engagement as well from education, government, and the community. And, of course, we've also been working with local industry experts. So our hope and our our goal has been that this would be something that would be very beneficial to you and the decisions that you will be making as a board moving forward. So I think with that, I'll just turn it over to you, Francesca.
Thanks so much for that introduction, Melissa, and thank you all for the opportunity to be in front of you today, albeit via video. We really appreciate the opportunity to connect with stakeholders across the community and just, you know, think so highly of your investment and diligence in your youth. So thank you again. Mandy, are you able to project the presentation? I think sharing is disabled on our end.
We're working on it.
You can go ahead and share it, Francesca.
Oh, okay. Can everyone see my screen?
Yes.
Wonderful. So we recognize that we don't have much time, and as Dr. Prater mentioned, this is really dense content. So we want to make ourselves available for one-on-one discussions and phone calls to talk through any of this subsequent to our discussion, and just really want to be a resource to answer any questions you may have. So we'll go through this at quite a high level, just to let you all know. So our approach, as Dr. Prater mentioned, this is really the output from phase two. So just to anchor everyone in what we've been working on. So we've been analyzing the Morro Bay Elementary School property to understand kind of what the highest and best use of that land could be, given the forecasted declining tax revenue and the high deferred maintenance costs of that site. And while going through this analysis of the property, we also sought to understand if the land could be used to meet another community need. So things like affordable housing or green space. And then understanding the flow through implications of potentially making that housing affordable or looking at different sorts of constructions, whether that's a high-density single-family or attached townhomes or for-rent townhomes, to really understand kind of the trade-offs inherent in that discussion. So in phase one, we did a market analysis, really understanding the current state of residential, retail, and office space with inflow, then looked at the highest and best use analysis. And on top of all that, we try to bring in the stakeholder perspective from the community. So really understanding the viewpoints of people like the Chamber of Commerce, the City of Morro Bay, local planners and architects, and school district employees. So we're considering not just those quantitative elements, but more of the qualitative nature. And now in phase two, which we'll present today, we're really looking at preliminary financial feasibility analysis. So what's the expected value it might be able to yield for the site? What does that mean from a procurement strategy lens? And then throughout that process, we also sought stakeholder input. So we conducted soft market sounding with real estate developers, and we met with the City of Morro Bay to better understand what the entitlement process would be. I'm going to hand it over to my colleague Dave now to talk through very quickly the recap of phase one and then lead you through what we discovered in phase two. Dave?
Yep. Thanks, Francesca. Good afternoon, everyone. So first, we'll start with the recap of the key takeaways from phase one report that we presented in March. So one thing that was very evident was that the residential land use appeared to be the predominant land use that the site can support. You know, the second thing that we found out was for sale, you know, for sale units could potentially represent the highest land value for the site. Then the third thing that we arrived in phase one was, you know, developing different types of residential products could diversify the income from the site. And the fourth major takeaway was, you know, the type of real estate disposition strategy, whether the school district decides to sell, lease, or swap the land, will determine how the revenue can be used. Now, with that as the context, let's quickly jump to phase two and some of the key takeaways from phase two. So as we know that, you know, COVID-19 has disrupted almost all industries, and real estate certainly being hit quite hard in California and in other parts of the U.S. as well. So for the next few months, you know, COVID-19 has resulted in an uncertain and stagnant real estate market in the county. Then the second key takeaway that we will walk you guys through is that, you know, a combination of for sale and for rent residential development on the site represents the highest theoretical, highest and best use value of the site. We've gone through different development programs and different variations, and what we've found is that the school district can expect in the range of $4 to $10 million in revenue from one-time sale of the property. Now, of course, the analysis that we've done was from pre-COVID level. So, see, and you know, when the real estate market recovers from the impact of COVID, you know, the school district can again expect a similar value for the property. Now, just a small caveat: the $4 to $10 million, you know, as will the $4 to $10 million number that we're presenting on the screen is for different variations, which includes different social and equity considerations. So, I will elaborate that in a bit. The third key takeaway is developing a manufactured home community on the site, you know, may provide an opportunity for school district with a source of annual revenue. So, you know, we've done a preliminary feasibility analysis for this option as well. And what we find is that this option can provide the school district with an annual income of almost $500,000 by leasing, you know, residential building pads on the site. Now, this option would also provide much needed affordable housing for the community of Morro Bay. And our fourth major takeaway is that, you know, finding the right property for swap in the current market might be difficult. So, like, in this current market, like, what you'll find is the majority of the revenue generating properties in the county are office and retail spaces. And these two real estate types have been most hit, you know, thus the owners and developers of these properties may not be interested in swapping the properties in this current climate. So with that as the key takeaways, there's one more slide on the key takeaways. Next slide, Francesca. Thanks. So this slide again, you know, summarizes our entire analysis. What you'll find is we've looked at three broad options. The first one is a residential development, which we call Development Program 1. This development program consists of medium and high density single family and for rent multifamily apartments. You know, this development type, we've looked at two different variations. One is an all residential variation, and the second is like a mixed use variation. And for this development program, the resident land value of the site, you know, what we've estimated is between $4 and $10 million. In terms of the procurement strategy for this particular development program, we think that the school district will most likely have to sell the site rather than lease the site. We looked at the market and we couldn't find too many promising lease case studies where, you know, public land has been leased for sale residential development. And also a P3 would be very likely given the appetite of the real estate development in the county. Now, some of the key risks during certain times is because of COVID, finding the right buyer who's willing to pay the maximum dollar in today's market will definitely be tough. Now, the second option that we looked at was the manufactured homes community. Now this site, what we've assumed that the site will be developed as a manufactured home communities and the building pads will be developed on site, which will be leased to homeowners. Now, for this particular option, we looked at two different variations. One was again, you know, an all manufactured home community, and the second was a mixed use where some of the existing buildings of this on the site were used as community center or as a childcare facility. Now, what we found out was that in terms of residual land value for the site, this is of course lower than option one. You know, we were in the range of $4.8 to $5.8 million. But the interesting thing is this option provides an opportunity for school district to generate an annual revenue from the site of around $420,000 to $500,000. And we'll walk you through the analysis next. Now, in terms of the procurement for this particular option, the school district can, you know, has the option to develop the site themselves and then lease the site to an affiliated entity who would run the site as a manufactured homeowner slash operator. Then there's the other option where the school district can partner with a land developer or a manufactured home developer and, you know, get and lease the site on a long-term basis, you know, somewhere between something like 50 to 100 years to the manufactured home operator. Now, some of the key risks for this particular option is that the manufactured home community may, you know, may face some pushback from the city of Morobe. Now, the third option that we, you know, looked at is, can the site be exchanged as is for a revenue generating real estate asset? Now in this particular type, in this particular option, the type of development on the site will be eventually dictated by the eventual owner of the site. Now, you know, what kind of value the school district can generate for this from the property swap option is difficult to tell as of now. I think that will have to be, that will be dictated by the RFI and RFP response if the school district decides to go this route. In terms of the procurement strategy, I think this will be a pretty straightforward. School district can, you know, test the markets through an RFP and an RFQ process to find the right buyer for the property. And, you know, some of the key risks for this particular option is that as the future revenue generating real estate assets such as office and retail are very uncertain during COVID, finding the right property might be very difficult in this current climate. And next slide. So our report is divided into three major sections. The first one is a feasibility analysis where we talk about some of the financial implications of Development Program 1 and Development Program 2. Then we have a section on illustrative development process. I think this is mostly information for school district to understand what the development process looks like. And then the third part of our report is the illustrative procurement options for the school district to understand how the procurement options might look for the three options that we spoke of. Now, see, we have only a few minutes on the call today, so what we'll do is we'll just talk about the feasibility analysis and then briefly touch upon the illustrative procurement options, and then we would be happy to take questions or have one-on-one discussions later. So in terms of the prototypes that we've looked at for this, for our analysis, we've looked at five prototypes. Three of them are for sale residential, and they range from single family medium density to single family high density, and then for sale condominium and townhomes. We've also looked at for rent residential apartments, and the fifth residential prototype that we've looked at is the manufactured homes. And next slide. So our development program one consists of a mix of the first four prototypes as highlighted in this yellow box on the slide. So development program one consists of a mix of single family, medium density units, single family, high density units, then condominium and townhomes and apartments. What we've assumed is that, you know, that this, that the first three prototypes, respectively, take around 20% of the site each. So that makes up 60% of the site. And then apartments, which are for rent, units, take up almost 40% of the remaining site. Now, this development program, was evaluated for four different alternatives. The first one was the base case where we assume that the entire site is demolished for market rate housing. Then the second one was where we assume that the existing buildings on the site are retrofitted for community use, and rest of the site is used for residential unit, residential development. The third variation was we assume that the existing buildings are retrofitted for community use, and the rest of the site has residential units, out of which 25% of the units are affordable units. And the fourth option that we looked at was that the residential, that the entire site is used as a residential development, but 25% of the units are preserved as affordable units. Now, so this is the summary of our development program two, development program one. Next slide. Now, in development program two, what we've assumed is that the entire site is will be built as a manufactured home community. We've looked at two different variations. Variation A, the base case, is where we assume that the entire site is used for market rate manufactured homes. And then the second is we assume that the existing buildings are retrofitted for community use, and the remaining of the site is used for a manufactured home community. Now, we'll quickly walk through some of the residual land value numbers for these development programs and the variations that we talk about, that we just mentioned. Next slide. So, I would like the school district to, you know, pay attention to the bottom of the screen to understand how we've laid out these slides. So, what we're looking at is development program one and variation A. So in variation A, we assume that the entire site is used for residential use and 0% of the site is used for community space. Then in terms of the units, what we've assumed is, you know, based on the existing affordable inclusionary housing ordinance in Morro Bay, 90% of the sites have to be market rate and 10% have to be affordable. Minimum is 10%. So we've used that as the threshold for the base case. And what we find is if the school district, you know, decides to sell the site as is, and the developer builds an entire residential development on the site with 10% of the units as affordable, then the residual land value for the site would be around $10 million. Next slide. Then, when we impose certain community and equity considerations on the development program, such that 36% of the site, which makes up for the existing buildings on the site, if those existing buildings are retrofitted and used for community purposes, and the rest of the site, which is 64% of the site, is used for residential development. Now, in this case, the residual value falls from the previous $10 million to around $6.6 million. So what we'll find is the number of total units go down from 160 units to almost around 105 units. Next slide. Now, in variation C, what we've assumed is that, again, only 64% of the site is used for residential development. The existing buildings on the site are used as community space, and that can be either, you know, we can decide on what kind of community spaces can that it can host. But in this option, we find that the residual land value falls to 3.7 million because 25% of the units are affordable. So from variation B, where we had only 10% of the site, units affordable, we go to around 25% of the units being affordable, and that brings down the residual land value of the site to $3.7 million. Next slide. And then the final variation for development program one is where we assume that the entire site is used for residential development. There is no community space, but with the caveat that 25% of the units will be affordable units. Now, in this case, the residual land value is what we've come up is at around $5.6 million. So these were the four variations for development program one. Now we'll quickly talk about development program two. Now, development program two was the manufactured home radiation, manufactured home option. Now, in this development program, what we've assumed is that the entire site is being used for a manufactured home community. So the existing buildings will be demolished and the site, you know, almost 9.4 acres of the site will be developed as a manufactured home community. So I would like the school board to pay attention to the green box, which is titled the business model assumption. So in order to do the financial analysis, what we've assumed is that the school district, you know, in this case is the landowner, and that they develop the land themselves and then they give the land to a school district affiliated park operator on a 50 to a 99 year old lease. And the school district affiliated entity will basically lease out the sites and maintain this and operate this manufactured home community. So for this business model, what we found was that this site actually, you know, presents an opportunity for the school district to annually generate around $508,000 for the school district in annual revenue. So it's basically around $500,000 in annual revenue from the school district. Next slide. Now the variation B of development program two was where we assume that almost 18% of the site will be used for community space and rest of the site, that is around 82% of the site, will be used for a manufactured home community. And then the business model assumption remains the same. And in this particular option, we find that, you know, the site can yield almost $420,000 in annual revenue to the school district. Next slide. So this slide basically, you know, captures some of the, all the results of the financial analysis that we've just mentioned. If you look at the current state of the site, you know, there are four buildings on the site. And currently the school district generates around $270,000 as net revenue from the site. But in the next 10 years, the deferred maintenance cost is estimated at $3 million. So, you know, when you look at the revenue and the maintenance, deferred maintenance cost, the site almost generates no revenue for the school district. Now for development program one, what we found out was the residual land value can range between $3.7 to $10 million depending upon different social and equity considerations. And this revenue will most likely have to be a one-time revenue where the school district will have to sell the entire land or most of the land to a private developer. The third option is where the school district has the option to either lease the land or, you know, develop a manufactured home community themselves. And in this case, they have the option to almost generate around $500,000 to $400,000 to $500,000 as annual revenue from the site. Next slide. So in the next few slides, we've illustrated the typical development process. I think for today's meeting, we will skip this part, but, you know, I would like the board members to just read it to understand what are the different stages in real estate development. And, you know, if they have any questions, they can definitely shoot those questions to us. So I'll take another couple of minutes to just briefly walk through the last part of a report, which is the illustrative procurement options. Yeah, so when the school district, you know, as they decide on what are the different, you know, like procurement options for the site, whether they want to sell the site or lease the site, I think they have to keep in mind four key risks. The first one is an entitlement risk. A project of this scale will have to go through an entitlement process, which can be a 2 to 3 year long process. And it involves a lot of time as well as financial resources for the party that entitles it. Then the second risk is the construction risk, and that is associated with construction of horizontal and vertical improvements. The third risk is the market risk, you know, whether what, you know, whether the eventual residential units on the site are able to lease or sold, whether there's a market for it. And the fourth one is the operation risk, you know, whether the entity that is operating the site, whether they're efficient in managing the real estate property. So the school district should understand what are the different risks involved as they make the decision for the site. Next slide. So in the next couple of slides, we'll briefly talk about what are the procurement considerations for development program A, which was the, you know, which was the residential development option. Now, if you look at this timeline, what you'll find is that the residential development has three major stages. One is a pre-development stage, then the construction stage, and the post-construction stage. Now, in the pre-development stage, school district has, you know, mostly two options, either to sell the site in its existing condition and before entitling the site. And in this case, the school district will not be taking the entitlement risk and they'll be transferring it to the eventual owners of the site. But for a site like this, you know, the entire escrow process to sell the site can be, you know, a multi-month or it might take up to a year after finding the right buyer. Next slide. The other option for the school district can be that, you know, they can take the ownership of the entitlement process. They can entitle the site and then they can go and find the right buyer for the site. Now, in this case, you know, the school district will be taking the entitlement risk. But what it does is the value of the entitled site is generally much higher than the value of an unentitled site. So because the school district takes the entitlement risk, they can also expect a higher sale value for the site. And the procurement for this case will be divided in two stages. In the first stage, you know, the school district can find the right partners to take through the entitlement process through an RFP. And in the second one would be, you know, the school district will need to come up with an RFP process for the eventual buyer for the site. Next slide. So now in this slide, what we've summarized is, you know, what would the procurement consideration be for development program two, which was a manufactured home, manufactured home community. Now we've looked at two strategies. Now strategy one is where school district or an affiliated entity develops, owns, and operates the manufactured home community. Now what this will look like is that the school district will take the site through the entitlement process and the school district will own the entitlement risk in this case. Then the school district will complete the horizontal infrastructure themselves and they'll be owning the construction risk associated with the horizontal infrastructure. And then the third one is the school district or its affiliated entity will again, you know, will act as the owner and operator of the manufactured home and own the market risk associated with it. Now, there's one thing to note is that the financial analysis that we've done, you know, through which we found that the site can yield around $500,000 in revenue for the school district was for this option. The second strategy would be that the school district partners with land developers to develop the site and then lease the site to a private, you know, manufactured home operator for a 50 to 100 year lease. Now, in this case, the revenue will be definitely lesser than $500,000. But again, this is an option also for the school district to explore. In this case, the risk that they take is much lower, which translates into a lower revenue from the site. Next slide. And then, you know, just some of the procurement considerations for the property swap option. You know, we've looked at a couple of case studies in California and the way they structured their property swap was first they came up with an RFQ stage where, you know, they were just testing the market to see if there are any potential buyers for the site. And depending upon the response of the RFQ stage, the school district went ahead with an RFP stage, which was the formal process to find the right buyer for the site. So if the school district decides to proceed with the property swap option, their procurement strategy could look very similar, where they come up with an RFQ and then an RFP stage. next slide. So I think we had discussed this slide in our phase one report, where, you know, we look at what are some of the legal considerations of sale versus lease to private entities. And what you find is if the school district decides to sell or lease the school district to a private entity, then they'll have to go through different steps. You know, they'll have to first make a written offer to different public agencies like the city and county, the park and recs department, the regional park authority. If they don't take up the offer, then they'll have to offer it to, you know, University of California or the Cal State University. And after those two processes are done, then they can offer it to private entities. Now, there's one, Francesca, can you just go back to the previous slide? Thanks. So there's one small caveat. The sale and lease of the property can, you know, there are limited exceptions. the proceeds of sale of surplus property must be used for capital outlay or on non-recurring maintenance costs. Whereas if the school district decides to structure a public-private partnership, you know, which is although very unlikely in today's market, they can use the revenue for for their operating expenses as well. Next slide. So I think this will be our last slide for today, where what we've done is we've superimposed the information from the previous legal slide and superimposed it from the previous slide with the three options that we have. So if you look at development program one, what you will find is the school district may have to sell the property rather than lease it to a local development community, because that is what the real estate community in the region prefers. Now, P3 for development program A, based on our conversations with real estate developers, looks very unlikely in today's climate. Then if you look at development program two, you know, the school district can explore the option of leasing the site on a long-term lease to a developer operator of a manufactured home community. And, you know, the local real estate community might have some appetite for a P3 for a manufactured home community, because the initial, you know, outlay in terms of investment is much lower than development program. Now, in terms of property swap option, you know, in today's climate, finding the right partner for property swap could be very challenging, but things will definitely change in the next 6 to 12 months when the real estate market revives. That might be a good time to explore the option of property swap. So I think with this slide, I think we would like to, we'd open it for questions from the board and the public.
Thank you. You know, I'm going to ask, first of all, to go to see if anyone from the public is here to address this item. No. All right. And then, Deb, thank you and your team for this presentation. I have just one clarification before I go to the rest of the board, and that is when the board has questions or wishes to gather more information or clarification, are you the person to contact?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Either via email or phone, you're the one to talk to be in touch with. Thank
yes,
you, Deb. Okay. And then anything from the board at this time? Dr. Prater, anything? Yes.
Yeah, I would just like to say I did meet with Deloitte and Reach earlier, and just let them know that this is a lot of information to absorb, and so We plan to revisit this in July and August for as long as we need to, just to, you know, let it sink in, let the questions come out. And this, we need to really examine this, and there's a lot there. So I just want to really acknowledge Francesca, Dave, and Melissa and Andrew. They've been fabulous to work with, super responsive and professional. Mr. Holcomb, the board's advisor, has been integral in working with and answering questions, clarifying. So it's been a good team, and I look forward to this process unfolding. As Melissa James mentioned, the Blue Ribbon Committee 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago, mentioned the importance of figuring out a revenue stream. And that's why we're here today looking at this. And I'm hoping to get this trajectory correct so that the board can make the necessary decisions, although difficult. I want to make sure that we keep the momentum and keep moving forward looking at these options.
Thank you. Mr. Unger.
So I guess Dr. Prater or Mr. Pinkerton or somebody, one of you two guys, I'm assuming. So it seems like one of the decisions we'll have to make is it more important for us to take a risk on long-term general fund revenues, or is there some advantage to actually selling the property over time that would provide us with the same kind of general fund advantage? Do you guys have any thought on that at this point?
Yeah, Ryan would have something to say about it, but what I've learned on this is that if you sell a district property, you're limited in how that one-time money can be utilized. And so in everything that I've read, that's sort of a dangerous and slippery slope, and that the ongoing revenue is the real strategy, I believe, we know we're going to need when the SB 1090 money runs out. So that'll happen in 5 years. So that's why this is important.
Well, isn't there also some risk because of the Naylor process?
Definitely with the sale, right? In terms of that, Mr. Unger. So, you know, if the district was to develop the property ourselves, then there'd be less of an issue in that way. You know, still a lot of hurdles to get through, of course, but, you know, risk equals reward, right? So that's kind of the, you know, any business venture is going to have that kind of tied to it. So I think it's something we just need to continue to dig into. You know, Deloitte did a great job, I think, in kind of summarizing where, you know, different options. And now we need to kind of lay those out for the board, you know, a few more times, right? Continue to have the conversation about, you know, overall costs. So if you know, are we willing to develop the site? And again, there's also issues that, like Mr. Buckman's brought up before, about, you know, teacher housing and equity issues, those types of things as well.
Thank you. Mr. Buckman.
Yes, thanks. I've got a lot of questions, but just quickly to sort of follow up on what Chris is saying or asking, my understanding would be that if we maintain the property and in the manufactured home scenario, if we maintain ownership and lease it, we can continue to do get revenue over time and not be subject to the Naylor Act. So then is there any reason why we could not do a mixed development of apartments or townhouses and condominiums that are built to those standards, rent those and lease those, and then if any time in the future we need a large cash infusion, we could go ahead and sell them as condos and townhouses. So is there a difference between leasing a mobile home and leasing another kind of unit?
Well, the biggest issue is just cost, right? As he's outlined, mm-hmm. You know, the cost of building rental units of houses, those types of things are much more expensive versus just laying out the infrastructure for like a mobile home park. where people would then buy their own, purchase their own mobile homes to bring on. So, you know, there's just a variety of cost structures that you would have to look at to, you know, to determine is it, you know, how much money is the district willing to put forth? And again, the more developers you have tie in, the more money they put into the project, you know, the less revenue that the district's going to see. So there's just lots of different, you know, cost benefits as we kind of lay out the different ideas. And we can look at that. And Deloitte has, they've kind of broken out houses versus condos and apartments.
Yeah. So I mean, sometimes for a better return, you make a better investment. There's also a development here in San Luis Obispo City that the city put in. My son happens to own one of them. You purchase it. It remains basically the property. You can only earn so much value into it, equity into it, and then it goes to another family that qualifies. That also seems like an option I'm not seeing. And then also there's a law that I think was passed 2 years ago that allows 650 square foot studios, which would maximize any of the square footage and return. So just wondering if, you know, at some point maybe that's looked at already, but if not, maybe we can see something.
So Mark, so if you look at our development program one, we have studios in it. So we have for sale units as for rent units, and for under those for rent units we have studios, one beds and two beds.
The studios that you have are 1,000 square feet. This would give you double the capacity.
I can talk about the details later. I think 1,000 is the average. So the way we've run the pro forma is we've taken a weighted average and we've run the pro forma. I can talk about the details on it, I think, on a private call, and we can go through those numbers. But we have a certain number of units as studios in it, which are, if I'm not wrong, 600 square feet, but I'll have to go back and check.
Ms. Roger?
Thank you. I'm wondering if we had below market rate units on that site, would there be any problem? Would we come up against any kind of issues related to gift of public funds, not getting highest and best?
Now, that is something. From my understanding, I don't think there should be an issue, but I think this is something that we'll have to talk to Lozano's, you know, lawyers from Lozano Smith and get the right answer from them.
It's just a question that came into my mind. Also, if we did develop the property and retained any of the existing buildings, Ryan, for childcare facility or community center or whatever the site, you know, might want, what kinds of money would we have to put in to making those buildings habitable or to bringing them up to the standard that they would need to be for that kind of use?
Well, I think, you know, Deloitte did a great job of laying out, again, the more space you develop, the more money revenue potential that's there, right, as outlined in their kind of project. So if you leave some of those current buildings, one really stands out, to be honest with you, and that would be the newer multi-purpose room area that the charter school currently occupies. Seems like it would be a great space to keep. It's relatively new. When I say relatively new, it's not 100 years old, it's 20 years old, right? But it's still in pretty good shape. That could be a nice community center, something like that for that area. So it's just, you know, looking at how much you want to develop the site and how much, you know, revenue versus keeping different functions. But that's definitely a building that we would want to consider keeping.
Okay. And then if we sell, well, the swap doesn't appear to be an option, really. If we sell the site to a developer, as is, or we remove the existing structures and we get the approvals for development of some type. So we sell it with plans and permits, or we sell it
entitlements, you know,
whatever. We still are restricted in the way that we're able to use the monies generated. They cannot become general fund monies, and that's what we're trying to obtain, our general fund monies. So it sounds to me like our only real, if that's what we want, then what we need to do is retain the ownership of the land, and that we need to be looking at a rent or lease option. Am I understanding correctly?
If you want a general fund, then yes, that would be correct. But I think now it's that cost-benefit analysis of what is it going to cost to get the site ready to do whatever development the board decides.
But because we're restricted from the proceeds of a sale become
restricted. We're leasing. I'm thinking more of if we actually lease the property. What would it cost us to get ready to lease?
Okay. It just almost seems like there
are... If we want those general fund dollars.
There are a couple of... If what we want are general fund dollars, and there are a couple of options that have been outlined for us here that don't generate general fund dollars, but rather generate restricted funds, then maybe those, it would be pretty easy to just take those off the table because they don't meet the objective. Am I clear?
I think you are, Marilyn.
Mm-hmm.
This will likely become a matter of breaking it down to, you know, kind of like what you've come to really quickly is what are our logical options given what's in front of us. And I think Deloitte here has done that really well.
Right. I agree that they have. And to me, it's a great presentation.
My hope is on July 16th that I would give you guys an opportunity to start hashing this around a bit more and narrow it down to what you likely have come to already.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Unger?
Ryan, so what are the chances that the main building at Morrowell could be declared a historic property?
I don't like to ask questions I don't want answers to, Mr. Unger, but... so far, we haven't found anything that makes it a historical building. Thus far, just so you know. Anthony Plaza, when he was the director of BGT prior to Mr. Bonin, had looked into that and had nothing.
Mr. Buckman?
Yeah, I just from past experience, I just want to caution about declaring something a historic property because then what it does is it limits the future use of the property. We had something almost similar when we were working on an agreement that the board had worked on before. When they did the Avila Beach and suddenly the schoolhouse popped up as an issue. So I think it's a great question. I just think we need to look at our past history.
Agreed.
Okay. Anyone else at this time? All right. Thank you.
Really did a great job. They really did.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Thanks.
Thank you, Francesca. And Dave.
And Melissa.
Melissa and Andrew, thank you guys. Andrew,
thanks very much. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity. It's been a pleasure.
You're good instructors with this difficult, big subject area for us.
Thank you all.
Okay, we will move on to 9.02, District Reopening Planning Process Update number 2.
Great. I'm happy to share with you an update on the reopening plans. So as you know, as we've spoken about previously, we are creating 3 separate plans. So these plans are what we're calling A, B, and C. And Plan A is our preferred plan, which is an in-person plan with extensive precautions and has a distance learning option. Plan B is very complicated, as it would include the county health department insisting that we utilize both social distancing of 6 feet, staggered schedules, and smaller group sizes. Plan C is our distance learning option that would be fully online, but new and improved from the lessons that we learned from the spring. So, Mandy, if you want to go ahead and show that flowchart graphic that you were going to show there. So we have had extensive input from a wide variety of groups in order to formulate the best plans possible. So we've conducted quite a few surveys, have worked with departments. ISLA has been incredible with their input. Lots of staff discussions about what's worked well and not. We have leadership teams around each of the plans. Of course, getting information from union leadership has been really good input from cabinet, from you at principal meetings, et cetera. I want to bring your attention to the circle there on the bottom right, which is the countywide planning team. So on Wednesday, I'll be meeting with representatives from the districts around our county to see if we can help to land in a similar place, the goal not being identical, but landing in a similar place countywide, because of the fact that although there are state documents that provide guidance, we are instructed to work with our county health departments, because as you know, every county is in a different place when it comes to the metrics around COVID-19. So that is our goal, to have commonalities within the county and then to have district-specific plans connected to that, that then provide more detail and specificity. So if you want to remove that, Mandy, I want to bring your attention to just a few key points within Plan A. So in Plan A, what you're going to find are some, like I said, some extra precautions. So I want to bring your attention to that. This does align with a lot of the talking points that Dr. Bornstein has also stated are representative of mandates and lack of mandates and things that she has within the county. So a couple of things to keep in mind. We would, of course, follow county public health guidelines when it comes to anyone that may test positive for COVID-19 and follow their lead for self-quarantine, for contact tracing, et cetera. That's really something that they lead, and we follow their lead when it comes to that. Of course, you're going to see a lot of information about increased disinfection and sanitation. As you know, from the spring, we've had voluntary certifications for people that are interested in using the disinfectant themselves. For example, I went through the module. In order to use the disinfectant, you know, you go through the module, take the test, and then you can use that. I just wanted that for myself, as people would visit my office, and I wanted to be able to, you know, spray things down. So those voluntary certifications are available for anyone to take that. We've ordered a lot of products. Chris Bonin's been great at ordering a lot of things that are needed, glass, gloves, mask, face shields. So face shields is an interesting topic that's really come about as a protective measure that could be utilized for instructors, teachers, aides, et cetera, that are up close with students, that would keep them from potentially having an instructional impact. So I know that we've heard a lot from pediatricians, et cetera, about potential instructional negative impacts from people wearing masks and students that are needing to, you know, see facial expressions, teachers' lips moving, et cetera. So face shields is something that we've ordered and that would be available. So the in Plan A, an important point to for you to know is that in this first draft, that masks are considered voluntary. Within our county, we have never had a mandate countywide of wearing masks, and I know there's a few counties, primarily, I think, because of our data and our metrics around COVID-19 in our county. So we would follow that same, you know, those same guidelines. Lots of additional hand washing, hand sanitizer. You're going to see protocols at the back of this. I think there's, you know, 15, 16 protocol documents, and likely would need even more to be created there. Something else to take note of is a strict enforcement of illness and sick policies. So, you know, we've, you know, in our district, and probably this is probably an American issue to tell you the truth, probably nationally, schools are a little lax about enforcing sick policies, and employees and kids coming to school when they have fever. There's almost a pride in America, right, of the coming to work sick shows some kind of work ethic. So it would be a much, you know, stricter enforcement of if you're showing fever over 100.4, sneezing and coughing, that you need to be home and be free from fever for 24 hours. Also, thermometers is another, you know, important topic. For our extended summer school, they ask that we take temperatures. We will see kind of where the metrics are and what that would look like. Right now, Plan A does not have the school site taking temperatures. But what it does do is it makes self-checks for families and for students, and kind of reinforcing ways to check and kind of teaching students and families, here's how you check to see if you're well enough to come to school. Looking at sick rooms at schools, also creating kind of separate spaces for first aid type of issues versus people that are showing, you know, fever, coughing, sneezing, and looking to see what can be done at school sites to help address those spaces. Of course, you're going to see a lot of things around social emotional wellness. I applaud you for approving, you know, additional MFT time, you know, things that within the launch plan that are really addressing a lot of social emotional issues that that, you know, we're hearing about, and doing some screeners at the beginning of the year is within the launch plan to see if we can get a handle on how people are doing and make sure that we know the students that are needing supports. Of course, there's a lot more details to that. I'm just giving you broad overviews today. We've had a lot of office accommodations like plexiglass installed between the person that has an interaction with the public. We would ask that there's no volunteers coming in. I know that's not a normal thing, and we, you know, typically really welcome volunteers, and I know we all value that, but just trying to limit the amount of outside public coming in, that we would start with that is one of our recommendations. Of course, additional trainings. I would also say in a classroom, things that you would see is in-person instruction. You would see desk at what we called reasonable spacing. So having reasonable spacing between it, it would not guarantee 6 feet of distance between desks, because that would put us into a Plan B. You would have to have less students at school in order to have that much distance between desk. So we're saying that there would be reasonable spacing, and of course, lots of guidelines taught to students in order to have them be respectful of one another's space. I mentioned the no volunteers, you know, things like doors and windows open for ventilation and a reduction of people handling doorknobs, guidelines of hallways, you know, maybe with blue tape. Some people talked about considering release times at the secondary so that you don't have hundreds and hundreds of kids flooding the hallway at the same time, maybe staggering some of those release times were some of the ideas thrown around. Of course, lots of discussion around how to handle things like lockers and locker rooms and PE and bathroom procedures, things like that. So you'll see a lot of protocol information related to that. Just a huge shout out to a wide range of people that really have been diving in and giving incredibly valuable input. You will see protocol documents for athletics. Mr. Pinkerton was right when we don't have any state or county approval. I don't believe it at the state level they've officially released county public health officers to begin to approve that. And for sure in our county, it hasn't been. So we're waiting to see when she's willing to accept those kind of proposals. We do have, if we're in Plan A, B, or C, what athletics could look like. As well as band and choir, we have not outlined every single extracurricular or co-curricular yet, but those are some of the big ones so far. As well as how to handle different behaviors, childcare, some classroom procedures. We do need more work around the classroom procedures, but food service, library, nursing, et cetera. So a lot of people coming together to give their ideas about what it could look like within A, B, and C. So in summary, I would tell tell you that we are still developing all three plans, just to make sure that we're being thoughtful and not caught on our heels in case we need to implement one. Dr. Bornstein is in favor of us submitting a plan A to her. Our goal is to have some additional board meetings to ask for your approval on a revised plan on July 16th. It would need the county public health officer's approval in order for it to be implemented. And then work is continuing with other school districts within the county to see if we can aim towards similar planning. Okay, happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. You know, first I'm going to go to the public and I have a few comments that I'll be reading. And secondly, those of you who are out there who perhaps weren't here at the onset, I'm going to just set out our basic protocols briefly. One is, since we're on Zoom, you need to use the raise your hand icon on your Zoom if you wish to speak, and we will do our best to address those in the order received, although I make no guarantees of that. And then we'll come back to the board. And right now, any speaker will have 3 minutes in which to speak. We're pretty strict about that timeline. We do have timekeepers here who will be keeping track of that. And at this time, I'm going to read in the three written comments we have received. The first is from Scott Arian, and please excuse me if I mispronounce anybody's name. As a parent of four children and the son and nephew of many elderly loved ones, I call on you to resume in-person educational services that are structured under the goal of maximal educational benefit to the students. We need to immediately halt overreactions to fears that have caused the district to abandon responsibility of stewardship to our children. It has been clearly shown by all reputable infectious disease research that COVID-19 poses minimal threat to children when compared to previously existing diseases and other health risks. The community should take care of those people who are at higher risk, but not sacrificing the well-being of our children. These children need social interaction and personal education for their development. I am asking you to prioritize the children's well-being and to stand up to local, state, and federal government as needed to defend our children's rights to a proper education. Next is Devin Kuhn Choi, and reading those remarks. I strongly recommend the district require all students, faculty, and staff to wear masks under plans A and B rather than leave them optional. Studies repeatedly demonstrate that wearing masks slows the spread of COVID-19. Importantly, science shows that even more than the wearer themselves, masks protect the people around them. Thus, the safety of students and teachers is at risk when others in their classroom elect not to wear masks. Requiring masks is especially important under Plan A, which the district has indicated it prefers. Plan A disregards CDC and WHO recommendations for social distancing, forcing students and teachers to be indoors in close contact with each other for hours at a time. This already puts students and faculty at significant risk of contracting COVID-19. Leaving masks optional exacerbates this risk, according to several studies. A Texas A&M, UT Austin, Caltech, and UC San Diego study recently found, quote, the difference with and without mandated face covering represents the determinant in shaping the trends of the pandemic. Our greatest concern is ensuring all students, Sorry, I'm just making sure that, okay, that was the end of that one. And next is, I'm just having trouble getting my page to work correctly. I think I may have, hold on one moment, please. Okay, I'm going to read the last one in a few minutes. I'm having trouble getting it to come up correctly. So at this time, we will go to the public. It looks like we have no one.
We have Devin Casey.
Oh, Devin. Oh, I believe that's who I was just trying to read and got sidetracked. Are you wishing to speak?
Sorry, go ahead, Devin. I accidentally muted you.
Sorry. So only the first part of my statement was read. I'd love
okay,
to.
Sorry.
If that's okay. No, that's fine. So in addition to the Texas A&M study, researchers at the Universities of Cambridge and Greenwich in the United Kingdom confirm that, and they argue, quote, face mask use by the public could significantly reduce the rate of COVID-19 spread, prevent further disease waves, and allow less stringent lockdown regimes, end quote. And they claim that the effect is greatest when 100% of the public wear face masks. I know there's an argument kids don't like wearing masks, but that just means that if we leave them optional, fewer will choose to wear them. And, you know, kids don't like homework or tests. That doesn't mean they should be optional. There's an argument many younger kids touch their faces if they're wearing masks. But if you've ever been in an early elementary classroom, you know, they're picking their noses. They're wiggling their loose teeth. They've got their hands in their mouths all the time. Wearing masks will actually curtail these germ spreading behaviors. And some families don't have access to a week's worth of masks. But that's why I would implore you to really urgently make this a requirement as soon as possible, because our wonderful community volunteers who made and donated thousands of masks to our local essential workers this spring might be called upon to make masks for families in need so all students can attend school safely. So the sooner we get that call out, the sooner that it could be fulfilled. You mentioned that the county doesn't require it, and so that's where we're taking our guidance from. But again, Plan A really has kids in close quarters with teachers all day indoors, and that's a very specific set of circumstances. So I would implore you, even if the county doesn't mandate it throughout the county, that the school district really require masks rather than leave them optional to protect everybody. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, I will now read the third and I apologize before, I just was having trouble with my computer. This is from Barbara and Bob Dorr. SLC USD School Board, we recommend a Plan B type reopening plan. At least Plan B has adequate child safety precautions contrasting with Plan A, which appears to be almost a normal reopening as if there is no pandemic. Our greatest concern is ensuring all students are protected from the coronavirus while at school and thereby protecting students, staff, and families. Please implement a plan with new classroom structures for better learning and safety, especially for older students, 7th to 12th grades. Both CDC and state Stronger Together reopening plans offer creative classroom structures. Please envision something better for our kids. Don't just return to the same unsafe century-old school structure. For example, have teachers create online classroom lessons, which can be used repeatedly by students who want to learn more or need help. Additionally, the state reopening plan gives many examples for different grade-level learning options for various groups. To minimize the spread of the coronavirus to students, families, and staff, please implement a reopening plan which includes the following. Medical grade N95 masks worn by all teachers and staff. Try it. Medical grade N95 masks worn by all students or no normal school day reopening. Try. guaranteed social distancing at a minimum of 6 feet, smaller class sizes, rotating full-day schedules with Friday distance learning, Plan B, creation of groups and cohorts of students learning together to minimize spread, and box lunches for pickup or delivery to classroom or outside eating. The fall 2020 SLCUD reopening plan includes a CDC three-step decision-making tool to determine readiness for school reopening, page 4. This decision-making tool is almost meaningless as it does not actually contain yes or no questions. Instead, it allows for bias or subjective interpretation. If such language were used on a student test, it would make all answers correct. The tool includes words such as if feasible, as feasible, encourage, reasonable, and promote. All answers allow for reopening. Ridiculous. The district plan A states the desire to make this plan a strong instructional plan that has plenty of safety and wellness protocols to address safety and wellness of staff and students. Please, the desire must similarly guarantee our students strong safety and wellness protocols. A strong instructional plan is expected as usual. The goal is a reopening plan safe from the coronavirus. We need stronger prevention strategies than you have provided. Thank you for considering Plan B, a safer coronavirus environment for everyone. So if there's no one else from the public at this time, I will come back to the board.
What, in your email as well, right?
Excuse me, that was it. Okay, sorry, we're just making sure I've gotten everybody. All right, back to the board. Any questions or comments, Mr. Buckman?
Yeah. Okay, So, first of all, a tremendous amount of work, three times the work in the same amount of time for three different plans. That's crazy. I noticed that there's no high school schedule in the plan, so I wonder if that's being worked on. I have just two questions, so this is my first, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure. So we do have created a sample elementary school plan, but as you know, the schedules are different for the middle schools and our, all three of the high schools are different. So that was just a start. And then, yes, we are having further conversations so that schedules can be made at the Plan B level. It is just very complicated. You can imagine at a comprehensive high school, having only half the students there becomes very complicated.
Madam Chair, can I ask my second question?
Yes, or shall please. I wait?
Okay.
Go ahead.
So when I look at the split day, so A group comes in the morning, B group comes in the afternoon, I'm thinking about all the transportation that's going to be needed to move those kids, especially if parents can't pick them up. Do we have enough room on our buses, and how do we pay for double transferring kids twice in a day? So double bus runs.
Yeah, Plan B, you're right, would be really difficult for transportation. We did check with transportation on each of the plans that we're considering, and, you know, they're an incredible group, so they would work and see if, what we could figure out. But, yes, as soon as you require social distancing on a bus, that requires that you're not transporting very many students at once. So maybe at maximum there would be, you know, say 20, 25-ish students on a full bus that's with social distancing. So we would probably have to make some tough decisions about how many bus routes are feasible and how do we figure out who's getting that ride.
Thank you.
Ms. Frame, unmute yourself, please. There you go.
Okay, thank you, Mrs. McGrath. This is, unbelievable. So this is just purely a housekeeping, and tell me if it's a request that can be done or it's just adding to your workload. You know, this is the first draft, and as you are in the process of making revisions, would it be possible to color code so when I read it again, I know, oh, that's the new, is that? I don't want to create extra work for you, but I just thought, a little bit easier than reading the whole document trying to find the revisions.
Yeah, it's a good point. I can maybe track changes and keep track of it. We do currently have a parent survey out and, you know, have asked for staff surveys. So as we receive that feedback, and I've, you know, had a lot of people asking about submitting feedback. So as we receive that and see things that need to be adjusted, and of course, if any of our metrics within our county data changes, we'll continue to update that. So a good suggestion. I'll keep track of what's adjusted.
Well, I don't want to create more work for you, so thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Anyone else? Mark?
Yeah, just one other thought occurs to me. And Kimberly, thanks for talking to me earlier so we didn't have to go through all my questions during the meeting. I pick my grandson up at school. Parents are all over campus. I'm wondering whether the pickup, parent pickup, would be different.
We would ask parents to limit the amount of on-campus interactions that are occurring. So, you know, we usually welcome it and love parents being there, and we would just ask in these unusual circumstances that they limit those interactions.
Thank you. Anyone else? My only comment at this time would be that I know what a huge lift this is, and the thing that is that we all need to keep in mind is how fluid this situation is. You know, just when we think we have something figured out, something may change. So I appreciate all these constant efforts on the part of everyone to just keep our heads above water as much as possible, and it's very difficult to predict this future since none of us has ever been there before. So thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. No additional comments? All right. We will move on to item 9.03, which is dual enrollment, college and careers access pathways.
Great. I'm happy to introduce Ms. Liz Moore, that is here to discuss the plan, really working cooperatively with Cuesta College. And thanks, Liz, for being here and doing some great work around this.
All right. I'm happy to be here and excited to just update you on dual enrollment. Can I share my screen? I'm going to try it. Nope.
Go ahead, Liz.
Thank you. Try it one more time. There we go. Okay. I've been working on dual enrollment with Allie Dexter and Sabrina Robertson from Cuesta. And you might remember that dual enrollment is where high school students complete a college-approved curriculum within the high school day in order to earn academic credits that are recognized by both the high school and the community college. There's a lot of benefits to dual enrollment. I've just highlighted a couple to share with you. You're earning college and high school credits at the same time, eliminating duplication of high school and college courses. Another benefit would be you're strengthening your college and career planning. So helping students be able to understand what college work is like and what the career might be like. And what does this mean for the students? There's quite a few reasons that a student would do a dual enrollment class. But a great thing for our students is that they're staying on our high school campus and they're taking this college-approved curriculum from their own high school teacher. So they're very comfortable and they can kind of ease into it. Our numbers from last year are about the same, but what it's showing us is that about 12.5% of our district high school students are able to take advantage of a dual enroll class. We have had auto and culinary and welding and engineering, computer science and graphic design and ag business, athletic training, video photography, and get focused, stay focused. Pacific Beach, next year, the agreement is to run Get Focused, Stay Focused, which is a course in exploring your career options and kind of getting a plan in place for your further education and training. At Morro Bay High, they have two new courses that we worked with this year, physics and Spanish 4, so that's exciting. And San Luis continues to have quite a few dual enrolled courses, and they're adding television and video production this next year, so that's exciting. So my conclusion is that dual enrollment is a great opportunity for our students. It helps our community partnership with San Luis Coastal and Cuesta. It's great collaboration for our teachers, and it is one of the indicators of success for what we're doing. Any questions?
Thank you. You know, first I need to go to the public. Is there anyone from the public who would like to address this? Thank you. And we'll come back, and I add Catherine, then Mark, then Marilyn.
Liz, you said that the student works with the high school teacher, so not with the college, the community college instructor. Is that new?
No, that's how we've been doing dual enrollment. So the college teacher and the high school teacher get together and review the curriculum, but it's delivered by the high school teacher. But it's the Cuesta College course, and it's just in your regular class.
Okay, great.
Yeah, it's really great.
Mark?
Yeah, I was looking at the contract, Liz, and thanks for all this. This is always such a great presentation. And I just noticed for the first time there's a clause in there, San Luis Coastal shall use money received for compensation for services under this contract. So the school district actually receives some money for participating in dual enrollment. Am I reading that incorrectly?
Yes, yes. The teachers get $500 for each section, and then the school district gets $1,000 for each section. So the teachers are able to do more with their classes, go on field trips, buy some equipment. It's great.
Yeah.
It's really great.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks. Marilyn?
Thank you. Liz, I was wondering the difference, the disparate number of classes offered at Morro Bay and at Slo High, is that solely related to the credentials that the teachers hold at the respective sites?
It is about that. We've been really thoughtful about trying to get each teacher who is at all in the realm of being credentialed the way Cuesta College needs them to be. Some of the courses need masters in that subject area, and so the high school teacher would have to have that. Now, that doesn't account for all of them, but you need to meet the minimum qualifications that Cuesta sets out, which are different for each class, but that's exactly what it's about.
So as the if the courses remain the same and our faculty presumably remains pretty much the same, we'll be seeing this disparity in offerings as we go on down the road.
Well, we keep revisiting it. Sometimes when there's a new head of a department at Cuesta, they will look at it differently. And then the programs, I think San Luis High has a lot of numbers from culinary, which is a great program that Morro Bay doesn't run. So, you know, we're just working on it every time, hopefully not to... We do have not as many students at Morro Bay as at San Luis High.
Yeah, I know. I know. I just want to get as many as we can for, you know, for each campus. And I know that you're working hard on it. So thanks for your efforts.
Thanks. We are beating the bushes. Every teacher asking them.
Great. Thank you. Any other comments at this time? This is an action item. And so we need a motion with regard to dual enrollment to approve the dual enrollment courses. Ms. Roger?
Question?
Oh, okay. But, you know, Marilyn, can you hold your thought? Walt has a question. I'm sorry.
Sure. I just wanted to make sure we're approving the courses, not the agreement that's been presented to us, but the courses that are contained within that agreement.
Yeah, the recommended action, as I read the agenda, is approve dual enrollment courses. Liz, is there clarification on that?
I think you have to approve I think that Mr. Millar is right. You have to approve the agreement that has the courses in it. I believe. Okay. Jim, is that right?
I do believe so, because it goes to Cuesta College's board as well. So, maybe I had poor wording there, but it would be for you to approve the courses within the full agreement.
Okay. Walt, are you Are you clarified?
I think that's what we are being called to do. Okay. Sometimes in the past when this has been presented, we'd have a list of courses like it's contained in the agreement, and then we'd agree that we would vote that we approve those courses.
You're right.
First time I've seen it within the agreement, but I just wanted to clarify which thing we're approving.
Yes, I know what you mean. All right, then I have Mark and Chris.
No, I think I'm in agreement with Walter. I think we're approving the agreement.
Yeah, that's what Kim just said. Okay, Chris.
So this is a question for Kim. Kim, sometimes when we've had agreements with Cuesta College, we have to do two readings. Is that the case with this? And so will this be brought back?
Good point. We used to, Chris. They used to require that this would come back a second time. That requirement has been eliminated. So it would just be one time only today coming to you.
Okay, anything else? Then I had, let me get this straight. Marilyn, you were making the motion, and then actually, Mark, I think someone else was seconding, I could be wrong. Who, raise your hands over again.
I don't know, I'm prepared to make the motion.
Yeah, I thought that's what I had. All right, Mark, I'll have you as the second. So, Marilyn, would you state your motion, please?
I don't have the agenda in front of me, but I approve the dual enrollment
courses
with Cuesta College, the agreement and the classes as outlined in the board item.
Thank you very much. Okay, and then Mr. Buckman, you're a second. Okay. All right, Catherine. I'm dispensing with last names at this point. Catherine.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Evelyn.
Yes.
Thank you. Walter.
Yes.
Thank you. Marilyn. Yes. Chris.
Yes.
Me, yes. Mark?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. All right. Next is item 9.05, which is an application for certificate of completion of staff development. We know it as the DI waiver.
Yes, I'll take care of that. We're going to do 904, the instructional plan.
You need, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. 9.04. I flipped my page too fast. The 2021-22 instructional calendar. Thank you. So, Kimberly, is that you, the instructional calendar?
You bet. Happy to do that. I think this is an annual item that comes forward, so just looking for your approval of that upcoming calendar.
Is there anyone from the public wishing to discuss this hot topic? Okay. Thank you. Then I would appreciate a motion, Mr. Millar.
I just had a question.
I actually have just a question. I'm just looking to see if the Abraham Lincoln thing that we had earlier is in this calendar.
Good point. I have not double checked that. Good point, but I'm not positive. I can't quite answer that, but we can double check that.
Okay. I am remembering correctly that a lifetime ago we considered some revision about Abraham Lincoln's holiday, right?
You're right. When it falls on correct week, right, which means if we take it at the Monday instead of the Friday, it falls within the incorrect week, and then we have to get your resolution.
Okay. So
this calendar does have the new date that the board passed with the resolution.
Great. Thanks, Ryan.
Oh, it does. Oh, thanks, Ryan.
I just looked.
Good checking.
No other questions by board members, and I'll move the instructional calendar for approval.
Thank you. Evelyn, did you have a question or comment?
I just quick. We've already approved the instructional calendar, right, for 21-22. This is, we're only approving or that change because of the Lincoln. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, that's all. Okay.
Thank you. Yeah. So then, would you like to second the motion? Oh, Marilyn?
Didn't we approve 2021, not 21-22?
No, we approved 21-22 in January, I believe. And we have to bring it back because we caught that we had the Lincoln's birthday in the wrong spot per ed code. That's why you're revisiting it today.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
I could change my motion then. Ellen?
Yes?
Can I recast the motion? Because I don't know if we've got a second.
What? We do not have a second. So cast your motion, please, Mr. Millar.
I approve the amendment to the instructional calendar as outlined in the previous board item.
Perfect.
I'll second.
Do we have a second?
I'll second.
Thank you. Motion by Mr. Millar, second by Ms. Frame. Mark. There you are. Catherine.
Yes.
Evelyn.
Yes.
Walt.
Yes.
Marilyn. Yes. Chris.
Yes.
And I vote yes as well. Motion carries 7-0. Now, 9.05. application for Certificate of Completion of Staff Development or SDI waiver.
We'll take care of that for Ms. Newland. That is a waiver that we're hoping we need to apply to the state for an employee that needs to finish some certification and professional development.
Anyone from the public wishing to address this on this? No. All right. Back to the board for questions or comments. There are none. Then a motion.
So moved.
Okay. Motion by Chris. And I'll second. So, Mark. Yes. Catherine.
Yes.
Evelyn?
Yes.
Walter?
Yes.
Marilyn?
Yes.
Chris?
Yes.
And yes from me. All right. Thank you. Next is...
Can I ask just a general question real quick?
Yes.
Since I had the opportunity to listen to the last board meeting, the audio recording, I'm wondering if the, and I hate to do this, gang, but I'm wondering if the raising the hand instead of audibly voting is going to provide a clear record. I'm happy either way.
Oh.
Yeah. I think that is a point well taken. I would prefer an audible response, but I also know that it would possibly lengthen the time as people, you know, take care of things. So, you know, but all things being equal, an audible response is most likely preferable. And that's why I then try and indicate the yes or no after I ask each person. So when I don't have an audible response. So hopefully we have it covered, but yeah, I think technically, I know how technical you are. An audible response would be preferable. All right, on to 9.06, Measure D, the new gym modernization.
Yes.
The new big gym.
We'll call it the main gym for now on, it's low high. So this is, as the board passed the resolution earlier, this is the completion of the termination of leases with Acme Construction in regards to the new gym, main gym project at San Luis Obispo High School. And so we're asking the board to approve that agreement tonight.
Thank you. Anyone from the public here for this? No. All right. Thank you. Any questions or comments from the board? Marilyn.
I don't have a question or a comment, but if there is no board discussion, then I'll move approval of the what are we calling it? The
termination agreement.
Termination of the lease, the lease-leaseback agreement with Acme Construction for the really new gym at Slo-High. Sure. Thank you. Mr. Millar, did you second Walter?
Yes, I second.
Okay, thank you. We have a motion by Marilyn, a second by Walter. Mark? Yes. Mark says yes. Catherine?
Thank you. Yes.
Catherine, yes. Evelyn? Yes. Evelyn says yes. Walter?
Yes.
Marilyn?
Yes.
Chris?
Yes.
And I vote yes as well. All right. Motion carries 7-0. We are moving on to our action consent calendar. Please let me know if you'd like an item pull. 10.01, Agricultural Career Technical Education Incentive Grants for Morro Bay High School and San Luis Obispo High School. 10.02, Approval of Certificated and Classified Personnel Items. 10.03, Acceptance of Donations. 10.04, Disposal of Surplus. 10.05, Authorization for Records Destruction. 10.06, Measure D, Approved Notice of Completion. Mr. Millar.
I move approval of items 10.01 through 10.06.
Second.
We have a motion by Walt and a second by Chris. Mark?
Yes.
Catherine?
Yes.
Yes. Evelyn?
Yes.
Walt?
Yes.
Marilyn?
Yes.
Chris?
Yes.
Motion carries 7-0. I vote in favor as well. Let me just get some of this paper out. All right, we are to item 12.01, reports by board members. Anyone wishing to make a report? Chris?
Yeah, I want to just say that I attended the bittersweet drive-through graduations at both Morro Bay and San Luis Obispo High School. You know, it was wonderful to see the seniors and their parents honored, and I'm just really hopeful that we'll be able to have a stronger in-person graduation in August as is planned. And then the next thing I want to talk about a little bit is a recent Supreme Court decision, Bostock versus Clayton, which upheld the rights of LGBTQ individuals to work without discrimination. During my time as a board member of the National School Boards Association, I was also chosen to be on their executive committee. And one of the items that came forward to the NSBA executive committee was whether to file an amicus brief for this particular Supreme Court case. I'm proud to say that we voted to support that, and I'm very excited that the Supreme Court did vote to uphold the rights of LGBTQ people to be employed without discrimination.
Thank you. Yes, it was indeed an important moment. Mark?
Let me see. I'm unmuted. Okay. So first, I'd just like to say thanks to all the board members. I was really proud to have reviewed a ton of resolutions from around the state and bring one forward to the staff and clerk for the resolution that we discussed. And I'm just so amazed and so wonderful that it sparked such a good conversation and pushed for an even stronger resolution. It'll probably be one of the strongest in the states when we're done. As the CSPA Region 9 delegate representing all of San Luis Obispo County, I've been able to share with everybody, hopefully everybody's gotten it, COVID and equity issues that have been brought forward in statements from CSPA. I also talked with Dr. Prater and received permission to go ahead and suggest to CSBA that rather than waiting till the annual conference, the CSBA come up with a webinar based on the best practices in our district, common ground, student senate, equity, and also from around the state, and try and produce a webinar. I haven't heard a no back, so I'm hoping that that's something that's possible. So it's great being on this board.
Anyone else? All right. At this time, this concludes our meeting of June 16th. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Ellen. Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
The recording has stopped.